All right, I think we're live. Namaste and welcome to the 36th edition of the Bharat Varta Weekly. If you find a familiar face missing, that's because Vatsa has had some pressing duties on the personal front. He's not available. Instead, we have Abhishek Paul, who you have seen on plenty of episodes before, joining us to discuss the news and events. Hi, Abhishek. How are you?
Hi, Kari. Hi, Ashish. I'm good.
Hello.
And of course, we have Ashish as well joining us. Plenty of things to discuss this week. Let's go ahead and talk about the episodes that we published. We put out a couple of very insightful episodes, one on foreign policy, actually both on foreign policy in some sense, right? Ashish, do you want to talk about your experience, talking to Shri Gautam Bambavale?
Yeah, so Gautam Bambavale is India's foremost expert on the Chinese policy. He was India's ambassador in his last role to China. He retired in 2018, and he has actually had three China stints where he has seen a lot of turmoil in terms of Indo-Chinese relationship. And he spoke quite candidly about the current border dispute, also the impact on the Chinese on the Pakistan side of the border. And the Indo-US relationship. He explained the overarching theme in terms of how we have gone about creating the China policy in the last few years, and also gave us a glimpse of how IFS works in general. So a very exciting discussion and very informative discussion. We usually don't cover foreign policy so much, and hearing it from someone who's a veteran, and not just a veteran, but one of the best in the history of the Indian diplomacy. That was quite an experience.
Right. And Abhishek, what do you think about the episode with the Honorable MP Bob Blackman?
Yes, Kari. So I think I really enjoyed watching this episode. I think it's the first time a foreign sitting parliamentarian from another country has joined Bharat Varta, right? So it was historic in that way. And Bob Blackman, who is the sitting MP of Harrow East, right, is known to be a really great friend of India, right? So he champions the Indian community quite a lot in his work. And it was great to hear his insights about, you know, how he has gone about, you know, building a connect with the Indian community there in Britain. And also, you know, being a conservative MP, you know, generally they're sort of looked at as, you know, a group in which, you know, the immigrant community will probably not be voting for them a lot, right? And some insights were shared about that in the show. But he's done really well in terms of building a connect with the Indian community. And also, you know, he was, you know, awarded the Padma Shri. And unfortunately, he's not yet been able to come and collect, but his excitement and about that was really worth watching.
I mean, yeah, I got also a sense that he knew about some of the issues more than some of the Indian MPs also would have known. Like, he was talking about farm protests the way we would talk on our podcast. So.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think he was also pleasantly surprised by Rohit Jayaraman's scope of knowledge, right, and depth.
Yeah, yeah. The stat around how he was the only conservative MP to win a Indian diaspora majority voting seat.
Not quite a diaspora majority, but top 20 with share of the diaspora, I guess.
Right.
The right way of looking at it. Yeah.
All right, Abhishek, you don't have to compete with Rohit. You know, both of you are good. All right, moving on. PLI schemes worth over 10,000 crore rupees for solar photovoltaics and white goods have been approved by the cabinet. The government will open bids for PLI over the next 2 weeks. The beneficiary manufacturing by offering higher PLIs for effective factories. It has already begun to attract some of the foreign companies as well. Ashish, you know, we've seen, we've talked about PLIs plenty before. Can you talk about this particular sector as such and what it's going to, how it's going to play a part?
Yeah, so PLIs seem to be the favorite topic for our weekly. And given that there are 12, 13 sectors involved, we also have new news coming in fairly regularly. But this one is quite critical. The first one, which is the appliances and consumer electronics industry. This industry is close to about 11, 12 billion in size before the pandemic, and it is expected to grow almost double in the next 5 years to about 20 billion. So there's a big scope of the local market itself. I mean, forget exports, but the local market itself can give a major boost to several players. And we do have several compliance makers who are based in India, but the imports are also pretty high. I mean, let's take an example of the ACs, for example, ACs as a category, right? So the AC market in India was about 75 lakh units last year, of which India imported almost one third of AC. So 25 lakh units were imported. But after the new import restrictions around, compressed machines and so on, the expectation is that for next year, when the market 2022, when the market becomes about 90 lakh units, India may actually end up producing 90% of that locally. So the impact of this PLI is fairly obvious straight away. I mean, it's a first year impact basically. And the expectation here is that the ACs, which have about 25% market, 25% value addition in the Indian market, in the Indian production destinations, will have about 75% local component manufacturing in the next 2 to 3 years. So we attract the assembly units pretty much straight away in the first year, and then also increase the localized components within those assembly units in the next 3 years or so. So that's on the appliances side. On the solar PV, again, the expectation is that this PLI, which is about 4,500 crores, will cover 10 gigawatts of capacity in the integrated solar PV manufacturing industry, which will bring in an investment of about $2 billion and will give about 1 lakh jobs. So that is the overall architecture in which the PLI has been designed. What we don't know right now is, like, who's going to come and manufacture? Will it be the Chinese players, or will the Indian companies also put their hands up and say that, okay, fine, we will invest in that capacity in India? This is important because India actually used to manufacture solar PV modules. In fact, in one of our episodes, Mudit Jain, who works for one of the leading clean tech companies in India, he had talked about this, that India was actually a leader in this segment just 12, 13 years ago. But because of Chinese dumping, we lost the advantage of manufacturing to China. So, I mean, we can get it back. It's not too difficult, but it will need new entrepreneurs to put in money. And hence a slightly difficult one to capitalize on. I would say that the appliances one is much more easy to implement. The solar PV one, of course, the ROI is pretty high, and I really hope that Indian manufacturers do participate. But in general, it's a little bit more difficult to implement because the costs of imports are very, very low right now. I mean, China has done a phenomenal job over the last decade in terms of reducing the production costs here. But I think that's the whole intent of the PLIs. Not all of them will succeed eventually, we know that. And given that India is a big market for solar, India is expected to add big capacity in the next 2-3 years. That is one incentive which hopefully will attract manufacturers. So fingers crossed on this one.
Right. For more on PLIs, Ashish has done plenty of episodes on this specifically. I mean, I think we'll link to it in the description. Do check it out. All right, moving on. The center collected a higher than expected direct tax for the financial year 2021. A net amount of 9.45 lakh crores was collected, and up to 40,000 crores from the revised estimated presented in the union budget in February. The high tax payout coupled with the revenue from union excise duties would allow the center to rein in fiscal deficit at a lower level than predictions. Robust GST collections in recent months have also brightened the prospects of the central GST collections being higher than the predictions. Abhishek, considering you're the chartered accountant right now on the panel, what is the big picture here? What benefits are we seeing from this?
Yes. So on this, as you said, right, the direct tax collections came about 104% of the revised estimate. So 9.45 lakh crores versus 9.05 lakh crores. In fact, the gross domestic tax, sorry, direct tax collection for the year is actually 5% higher than, you know, fiscal 20, right? It came at about 12.06 lakhs crores. But on the flip side, what happened is the refunds given out in this fiscal were much higher, about 42% higher at 2.61 lakh crores. So what has happened is, you know, with more faceless assessment and appeals and more use of IT, I think the refund process has become much more swifter. And so we are seeing a lot more upfront refunds. Also with the pandemic, you know, coming, it made sense for the government to help out as much as possible in the refund space. So on the big picture, I think things are not great, right? In terms of direct tax collection, this is the second year in a row that we have seen a drop year over year, right? So in FY19, India's direct tax collection was at 11.36 lakh crores. And after that, we saw about a 7.5% drop in FY20. That is almost, that is pretty much the pre-pandemic picture. That was at 10.5 lakh crore. And then this year, we are down to 9.45. So this year, of course, is more to do with the decline in economy in the pandemic. So next year's estimates in the budget are about 11.08 lakh crore, which is a 17% increase. Now, while the number looks big, this is kind of in sync with the double-digit growth that we are expecting in the GDP as well, right? So a couple of things to note within the direct tax picture, right? The corporation tax part of it has been, the drop has been much more, right? So about this year's estimate is 4.57 lakh crores versus last year of about 5.57, right? So the big drop has come in the corporation tax space. The income, personal income tax space has been sort of flat year over year almost at about 4.9 lakh crore, right? So the other thing that is being talked about slightly as an aside, but worth considering for us is that recently, you know, Janet Yellen, who's the Treasury Secretary now in the US, and she's talked about having a global alliance on a minimum tax initiative, right? So you, the US corporation tax rate right now is about 21%. They're talking about making, bringing it up to 28%, right? And the Indian sort of adjusted tax rate is also close to the US rate right now, about 21.6. So what the current and Biden administration wants to do is increase corporate tax rates, but also sort of have agreements with many other countries to bring the average rate closer for all these countries to around the 28% level, so that the tax avoidance that is happening, you know, in which, you know, companies go to exotic locations and sort of avoid taxes, that can be minimized or stopped. So interesting to see, you know, what happens on that front.
All right, moving on. The Punjab government has implemented direct bank transfer for their farmers, bypassing the existing Arthiya system. The state has already begun procuring the massive 130 lakh tons of wheat crop for this season. Under the new method, farmers will directly receive the MSP for their products in their bank account. Reportedly, the center forced the state to implement the scheme, threatening to not buy the crop if the new system was not followed. Punjab Chief Minister Captain Amrinder Singh ordered various steps to ensure the continued involvement of Arthiyas in the procurement process. This came after they went on a strike protesting the new scheme. Ashish, it seems like the center is not budging. How do you see this panning out?
This is actually a very important victory for central government and the tussle between the center and the state. I'll give you a bit of a background here. So the PFMS, or the Public Finance Management System, was implemented by India in 2009. It was an electronic system which connects all the states with the central treasury. And the idea was that the PFMS would be used for all money movement between center and state. I mean, going back to the infamous statement once made by Rajiv Gandhi that if Delhi gives 1 rupee, then 15 paise reach the states. The idea of PFMS was to keep that 1 rupee as 1 rupee, in the sense that have as many direct transfers as possible without having any exchange of money or cash through the chain. And not just to the states, but actually the beneficiaries in the states, right? So that was how PFMS was envisaged. And in 2013, starting 2013, PFMS was starting was used by the central government to put in DBT in place. So I mean, all DBT works via the PFMS basically. Now, of course, different schemes took different times to get onboarded, and by 2017, the Modi government made PFMS mandatory. At that point of time, Punjab was not compliant on the agriculture benefits transfer, given that the Adatiyas play a critical role in the state. Now, why do they do that? Because about 40,000 farmers in Punjab are supposed to be absentee farmers, which means that they could be living in Canada, UK, Delhi, or wherever else, but they have got farmland, which the Adatiyas manage on their behalf, and they maintain a verbal record of who's tilling the land. So let's say a landless, I mean, let's say a not a laborer farmer from UP or Bihar can go to Punjab, lease a land or rent a piece of land, and then basically do the you know, agricultural work for a season. And this is managed by Adatiyas in terms of, you know, think about it as a someone having a flat and you know, in a society but living in the US and having a local broker manage that, right? So that's what Adatiyas do in Punjab. And hence they used to, the idea was that the money should go to Adatiyas, and they basically transfer the money to the, in some proportion to the tillers, to the rentiers, and to the actual landowners. Now, this issue was also there in Haryana, but not as big. And Haryana actually also integrated land records with the PFMS starting this year. So Punjab was the only state where no integration, no electronic records were maintained as to who the money was going to. That the money was going to Adatiyas, they were supposed to keep, they call it a Form J. So they would fill the Form J and keep the details to themselves. But no one knew whether it was right, wrong, you know, who's the actual beneficiary. So that has now changed. And what happened in the meeting with Piyush Goyal, who's the civil supplies minister right now, after Mr. Paswan passed away. So he basically told Manpreet Badal, who's the finance minister of Punjab, that the central government will not procure for Punjab at all this season. And as you know, the Rabi marketing season, or RMS as we call it, that's starting now, like Monday, basically tomorrow, right? So there was an urgency on getting this done. And several extensions had been given to the Punjab government, but they were refusing to comply. But this time they had to. Also, because some 29% of the procurement in the last season, in the last procurement season, you know, for all the procurement that the government, central government did for the Kharif marketing season, the previous one, 29% of that happened in Punjab. So, in any case, I mean, you know, the threat would have played out, because states like UP, MP, Bihar, they have always feel shortchanged because of this, given that they have made rapid progress in agriculture in the last decade. And so Punjab had to relent. Now the next question is, how do they manage the Adatiyas, right? For example, they went on a strike yesterday, but ended the strike after 2 hours. So I think the Adatiyas also understand that there isn't much of a option here in terms of, you know, for them. And they have relented at least now. Now, when the land records are implemented and integrated in the PFMS, which is 6 months down the line, Punjab has got 6 months grace for that. That will definitely be a big blow to Adatiyas, because then all the contracts would have had to become written and not verbal, and they will be managed electronically and not via an individual. So that's another battle for the next, for the Kharif marketing season 21-22. But interesting times, because this can also impact the farmer protests going on around Delhi, in the sense that there's one reason less for the protests now to actually exist.
All right, moving on. It's been raining unicorns, as six new startups have entered the Unicorn Club in the last week alone. Fintech startup Cred, social media startup ShareChat, wealth management company Grow, messaging platform Gupshup, social commerce startup Meesho, and e-pharmacy Farmeasy were the companies that achieved the unicorn status just last week alone. So I feel like I can cover this in a little more depth. Let me give you a few numbers, right? So there are roughly around 50 unicorns in India. Globally, there are 600 unicorns. 50% of these unicorns are based out of the US or headquartered in the US, US companies. About 25% of them in China. But if you see how India is catching up, India is right now third in the race, right? And we've already had about 9 unicorns this year, and as I mentioned, 6 in the last week alone. All of these spread across very diverse businesses, right? Health tech, social commerce, infrastructure, e-pharmacy, and so on. Last year, the number of new startups launched fell by about 70%, and the funding was about 10% lower than 2019, right? But the number of deals went up, right? The number of deals, VC investments actually went up. And this year, by some estimates, I mean, I remember reading Inc. 42 and so on, we're expected to do about $13.7 billion of VC investment, right? And the previous, this is which will actually be a peak for India. The previous peak was around 2017. Now, you know, given all these numbers, right, let me put some of this in perspective. What does this really mean? Now, 11.5 billion is actually nothing, right? If you look at global VC activity, it's around $300 billion, right? So that's 11.5 is around 3 to 4% or probably lesser, I think, right? And US corners nearly 50% of this entire global VC money as well, right? So they come in at around 146 billion. Now, we've always had seed and series A investors here, and I feel it's improved. In fact, there's a lot more activity at the series A and pre-series A seed stage. But what's interesting right now is that a lot more growth stage funds will come in. You know, Tiger Global raised around $6.6 billion just this month, in fact, April 2nd. And given, you know, that the low interest rates are pretty low around the world and it's going to be that way, a lot more growth stage capital is going to come into India. And, you know, I mean, I don't see this, founders shouldn't see this as exits, but really as fuel to really go all out and leverage and build really, really big businesses, right? So I think, you know, plenty of these deals were also sort of in the run up to an IPO. So you saw Zomato raise a bunch of money, and then you saw plenty of others as well, right? So so this is last call in for some of the investors in some sense, right? And anytime we talk about funding and all of these things, there's always a voice on, you know, concern on losses. Of course, we have a chartered accountant on the panel today, so I'm sure that he is looking at right hand side, left hand side, all of those balancing things, and, you know, thinking about losses. But you know, just to remind you guys, I think it's a different sort of a business where you go for scale and then, you know, cash in on profits at scale. So Amazon took something like 18 quarters to turn profits, and you know, last year they did about $21 billion in profit. And it's not just Amazon alone, right? Amazon, of course, is you know, one of those examples that's often brought up. And you know, to achieve Amazon's level of execution, it's you could almost think of it as an outlier, right? But there are other examples. So Airbnb, for example, took 6 years, massive funding, raised a bunch of cash, and then took 6 years to turn profitable. And despite COVID, right, where there were travel restrictions and everything, they did fairly well last year. In fact, I mean, there's a very good podcast of Brian Chesky where he talks about how literally 70% of his business vanished in April and how they've recovered from there on, right? Tesla took 10 years to turn over a profit. And, you know, these are not new things, right? I mean, anything... these kind of businesses do take time. Like, for example, FedEx, right, is one of the famous examples, legendary examples from years before, right, which took a long time as well to turn over a profit. The other thing is, so just to round up that last point, I mean, you know, wait it out. Don't be cynical about all the, you know, losses and whatever it is that, you know, people talk about. The more important thing for us, I feel, is the second order effects that this will happen, right? I mean, we've seen plenty of buyback activity over the course of like the last 6-7 months. Unacademy has bought back ESOPs. Zomato has bought back ESOPs. Urban Company has bought back ESOPs. This means that, you know, a lot more people in the ecosystem are making money. Startup ecosystem are making money. These are early employees and so on and so forth. So which means that, you know, arguably they will start funding startups, they will start up themselves. And as consumers, I mean, you get better and cheaper services, I would say, right? So Overall, I think it's a very positive thing, considering that I think on some axis we'll have to leapfrog institutions and directly go into some kind of startup innovation, like education, for example, right? Do I believe that there'll be the likes of Stanford's and whatnot built in India over the next 5, 10 years? Not likely. I would more bet on the likes of Byju's or an academy creating that next level of education infrastructure and services for India, right? So on all of those fronts, I think it's a very, very positive thing. Ashish, Abhishek, anything you guys want to add?
So, I mean, the one effect I saw was the Californian VC money making Gunda out of Rahul Dravid. So I think it's quite transformational, I must say.
Of course. Ashish, your favorite ad in recent times, right?
Of course, I mean, the Indore guy has been changed into a Bangalore Gunda, so it's not acceptable.
I think some of his irascible Indori tendencies do tend to flare up, but yeah, he retains that Bangalorean class,
I liked it so much, I made that picture my Twitter DP, you see.
right? All right, moving on. So, Congress State President Nana Patole accused the center of playing vaccine politics with non-BJP states. He alleged that the center was discriminating against states by rationing vaccines, calling it their, again within quotes, biggest sin. Prime Minister Narendra Modi also responded to these allegations, saying, "I have been putting up with all kinds of statements. I choose not to open my mouth." Union Health Minister Dr. Harshvardhan accused Maharashtra of diverting people's attention from its dismal management of the pandemic by blaming the center for vaccine shortage. Maharashtra has been allocated 1.06 crore doses of vaccines, while Rajasthan has got 1.04 crore doses and Gujarat 1.05 crores. There's a huge demand for vaccine as the country is in the throes of a second COVID wave. Ashish, your thoughts on the situation?
I think it's a fairly complex situation. The supply chain is currently running in a JIT mode, in a just-in-time mode. So stockouts are going to happen. It's inevitable. The politics is also inevitable, unfortunately, because that's how India runs. There'll always be some back and forth. But actually, I see the positive side of this. India has hit 10 crore vaccinations in about 85 days, which is fewer number of days than what US and China took to get there, right? And also the fact that we've also exported about 6.45 crore doses, which has earned us quite a lot of goodwill. In the larger target scheme, which I mean India has of getting 30 crore people to get vaccinated by July, the 6.45 crore doses may not be that big a deal because that's like 3 crore more people than the target population. So it's while I mean people have been cynical about why are we exporting, etc. The fact is that it doesn't really change much on the domestic front per se. It's like a month's production eventually. I mean, we will eventually get there when in a month we will have those many vaccines being produced locally. So as such, not too bad a situation as of now. Now, of course, the problem is that Indian scale is unparalleled, right? So you can say that we've vaccinated more number of people than the entire population of several countries. But our scale is also humongous. Having said that, the fact that India could match the pace of US, which is 34x our per capita income, that just shows that there are natural limitations to this process, right? I mean, if we could do something at the scale of US and at the speed of US, and yet get nowhere in terms of the results that we expect, it just shows that it's a complex problem. And I don't think there is much more to be done, barring the fact that we continue the pace and get new vaccines in. And I think that's going to happen in the next, let's say, 2 3 months when we will have the Sputnik V from Russia being manufactured in India. Hopefully, they will get the emergency use authorization very, very soon in the next, let's say, 2 3 weeks. So that should add about 250 million doses to Indian production. They are going to manufacture 1 billion in India, 750 for exports. And then J&J single dose vaccine, which will come with the quad obligations, which was discussed in the previous or the I think in one of our weeklies, maybe 2 weeklies ago. So overall, let's be optimistic about this. It's a difficult situation. This politics is inevitable, but also I think, largely speaking, India has done quite well from where we were and the resources which we had.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Mallika Srinivasan, head of TAFE, has been named the new chairperson of the PESP. the public enterprises selection board, which was functioning without a head for 7 months, is in charge of evolving policy for central public sector enterprises. The appointment of Ms. Srinivasan represents a higher degree of collaboration between public and private sectors. While these positions were previously held by favored bureaucrats, the appointment of a professional might signify a brighter path forward. Abhishek, talk about the larger significance of this.
Yes, so it's a positive development to see such an industry stalwart who heads, TAFE and is on several other boards as well, right? So a very accomplished corporate leader getting a post like this in the government. So this PSEB, right, sits in the Department of Pension and Personnel Training as part of the Government of India, right? So as you said, they are responsible for selection of leaders for our hundreds of central PSUs, right? As well as, setting up measures for their personnel, performance appraisal and other things. And it's great that someone from the industry is coming in. We would expect, more sharpening up of and more basically more professionalization sort of brought in into the picture so that our PSUs, those who are doing well can keep doing well and others can sort of turn around with this professional oversight.
All right. So that's it from us this week. Thank you again for all of the support that you guys have been giving us, right? People continuing to say that we are underrated. Like Ashish says, hopefully for not for too long, right? Thank you again. And, we have premium subscriptions as well. There's Plus and there's Prime, a bunch of benefits that you get on YouTube. Please click on the join button and, join our community. Thank you again for your support and look forward to seeing you guys next week on another edition of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. Please stay safe, take care and Jai Hind.